Hello and welcome to Batflips and Nerds, the baseball podcast with a British twist. I'm Darius Austin and I'm very excited today to be joined by an extremely special guest, a former major leaguer who's turned his hand to analytics and also the co-host of a web show now. It's former Oakland A's player Nate Freiman. Nate, thank you for joining us.
Hey Darius, thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's really great to have you on, and we've got a lot of good questions. I know my co-host John McGee has sent in quite a few. He can make it tonight, but definitely a lot of things you want to ask about. So I kind of wanted to start with the show that you're doing on FanCred, the launch angle, which you're doing with Josh Zide, who also was going to join us and unfortunately couldn't make it tonight. So I kind of just wanted to hear a little bit about that. How did it get started, and what should people expect if they tune in?
It's an app out of Austin, and they do this really cool platform that's live video, and you can call in from anywhere in the world and in real time ask a face-to-face question. So that's something that is new to me. It's a really cool technology. And so Josh Zide and I played together in a bunch of places in the minor leagues. We played together in the World Baseball Classic, and we played together with Houston. So he's a guy that I know really well. We go back a long way, and it's fun talking baseball. Then we sort of mix our experiences in the minor leagues and the big leagues with, we're both getting into analytics, and we inject that into the conversation too. And we have a really good time.
Yeah. I've watched a bit of it, and it seems like you guys have a lot of fun and a good rapport there. So yeah, I definitely recommend that people check it out. So you said that Josh is kind of getting into the analytics, and you've certainly, made some waves lately with kind of being a player who's really focused heavily on getting into R, and we'll talk about that in a little while. But is Josh kind of following a similar path, or is he kind of letting you take the lead on the deep stuff and that kind of thing?
I think I am more drawn to the numbers than maybe he is. But once we started talking about the analytics and he started getting into it on his own, he's getting really good at it. And he'll come up with stuff for the show and just be like, wow, where'd you find that? Or how'd you come up with that? He'll just have really creative number stuff that he's getting into. He does a great job with it.
Yeah, and with the title of the show in mind, certainly we've heard a lot about launch angle lately and swing changes. Do you think that some of the newer data we're getting from StatCast and maybe the kind of the change in the environment we've seen more recently with the change in the baseball as well, do you think that would have made a big difference to your career if you'd been playing kind of 3 or 4 years later than you did?
I would have loved the chance to hit the baseballs that they've been hitting the last couple of years. I think that definitely would have been helpful, but unfortunately it didn't work out. The launch angle stuff and the swing changes, I don't think that would have helped me. I think that I would have gotten myself in trouble by trying to hit the ball in the air more, and I was best when I tried to hit line drives. But it's really fun to watch, and it's fun to talk about. And yeah, the launch angle, it's sort of a nod to the advanced metrics that are coming out of the StatCast data, but it's sort of a play on words where it has the word angle in it, as if it's our take and our opinion on what's happening. So we had fun coming up with that.
Yeah, I think it's a particularly appropriate title for the age of baseball that we're in, certainly. With the analytics, was that something that you were already into as a player? Were you talking to like the stat guys on the teams and that, or was it kind of as you were thinking about retiring and that was when you really focused on getting into it and learning R and developing your own analysis of the game?
It's amazing how quick things have changed in the last couple of years. So my last appearance in the big leagues was 2014, which is now 4 years ago. And the pace that the analytics are being implemented in baseball is just totally accelerating. And when I was there, we just didn't have the stuff we have now. And I spent the 3 years after that in the minor leagues. And so even greater extent, we just had the basically traditional methods, traditional scouting. We might be told he throws certain percent fastball, certain percent breaking ball, but in terms of the spin rates or all this really cool esoteric stuff, we didn't have any of it. So I have picked it up really since I got done playing.
Cool. And this is kind of something I think that a lot of teams are working on communicating to their players now as well. I've certainly read about the Pirates having like a liaison, basically, who sort of focuses how do we communicate this data to the players. Is that something that you think you personally would be interested in doing in the future?
I think that'd be a really interesting job. It would combine some stuff that I'm really interested in with the actual playing to get to interact with the players and on-field performance with the numbers themselves. I think that'd be a really fun job to have.
Yeah, I think certainly for a long time it seemed like a sort of battle. We have these two sides, and I think they're coming closer together now. But I think for a while it was how can I use this? And I think you personally have talked about how you would sometimes overthink things at the plate, and I think a lot of guys, that's true for, right, that they don't want people to give them all this data before they go up. They just want to see the ball hit the ball kind of approach.
Absolutely. Hitting is hard enough when you're just trying to hit the baseball. And once you start factoring in angles and spin rates and stuff, it's pretty easy to get overwhelmed in the box and just start thinking about things that maybe aren't immediately relevant to hitting the baseball. And that would have been me if I'd had all that in the batter's box. But now that I'm done and it doesn't affect me, I'm not trying to lay off sliders in the dirt and hit fastballs. I'm enjoying it just for its own sake, for the intellectual challenge of learning about everything.
Yeah, it's very interesting to hear your perspective, and it's you've already done some really interesting stuff, including coming up with your own kind of metric, I believe, about sort of run values per pitch. Is that right?
I did. I was looking at the raw Statcast data, and they have 87 or something like that variables on every pitch. It's incredible. And I was having a really good time. Basically, you can find on every single pitch thrown the score. And so what you do is you just take the run differential on that particular pitch and you average them out over whatever time frame you want, whether it's per batter, per inning, per team, per week, per whatever. And it was kind of fun. I was having a good time with it. It turns out that if you look at the average run differential in just the eighth inning for a team, it is actually a pretty good predictor of your winning percentage, which I guess isn't that surprising. If it's kind of like saying, what's the score late in a game for a team? And if you're usually losing, you're going to have a bad winning percentage. But I've had a good time doing it.
Yeah, I think it's probably quite a good way to learn about these things as well, to create something like that yourself. What are the kind of resources if somebody listening to this is thinking, well, this is the kind of thing I'd really love to do, but I don't know where to get started? How did you teach yourself this? Were there websites or people you talked to? What did you go to?
Yeah, I just went online. There are a lot of free resources online for learning coding. And one of the reasons I picked up R is it's free. It's open source. You can just download it and start playing around with it. There's a ton of stuff basically just using Google and going to some of I think they're called Massive Online Courses, just for free. There are all these places like Coursera and some of these places where you can just basically take online courses, not necessarily for college credit, but to learn. And so that's what I did. And as I was learning, I would go onto the public databases, the Pitch Effects data and the Baseball Savant data, and I would just download the raw data and start manipulating it and really had a good time.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of resources out there and so much data now, I think, that for people to get stuck into, it's exciting. And I can say from personal experience that something like R is much more appropriate than messing around with these things in Excel, which tends to crash when you try and challenge it with anything.
I started with Excel. This is before I was so intimidated by the idea of coding that I just thought I would start with Excel. And I hit the limitations really fast once I started using the Savant data. And, you know, you download 2 weeks of data from Baseball Savant, and it has 40,000 rows. And Excel, it's basically a non-starter to try to move that into Excel.
Yeah, it does slow down very fast. It's fine if you're doing a leaderboard from 2017 or something, but it does break down very quick with the volume that they've got, doesn't it?
It does. And again, I really wasn't my original intention to learn to code. Honestly, at first it was totally intimidating. But then I just said, fine, let's do it. And it's been addicting. It's as if I found this video game that I, I can't get enough of. So once the kids are down and, you know, stuff's kind of taken care of around the house, I'll fire it up and, you know, an hour or two will go by.
Yeah, it can be a pretty cool experience. I was kind of wondering if, from your perspective, the current array of stats we have is obviously incredible, but with what you've done so far and kind of the having the side of the player to approach it from, as well as having learned to code, is there something that you think there's a gap in or maybe an improvement that you think could be made to the way that maybe sabermetricians have been analyzing the game? Have you got some ideas about stuff you'd like to see improved on or maybe added to?
That's a good question. I'm not approaching the numbers from the perspective of I played the game, so I know better. It's really, I played the game, now I'm interested to know the type of sophistication that's going on in the writing and analysis of baseball, because on the field, there's sort of a limited bandwidth that you can apply. You can basically look at velocity or fastball slider combination, but we're not going to go back into the clubhouse after the game and look at these crazy models and predictive algorithms for, you know, winning percentage, strike zones, aging curve. We just aren't going to look at that. So my goal isn't necessarily to say, oh, I played, so I know better, and let me improve on this. It's, oh, I played, I was never had the ability to really be exposed to this, but this is amazing. So I want to learn as much as I can.
Yeah, absolutely. I kind of wanted to ask about the sort of the non-analytics side, sort of from the perspective of the kind of chemistry and makeup thing. And you wrote a piece recently that went up at FanGraphs that was inspired by Nick Punto, who was kind of known as like a scrappy guy, great clubhouse guy, you know, good competitor. You also mentioned how funny he is. How important is it having a guy like that around, and how much do you think it brings to a team that can't be quantified?
I wish I could tell you half the stories that I have about Nick Punto. He was unbelievable. I was a rookie, or I actually was not a rookie. I sort of perpetually felt like a rookie around the veterans, but he was a guy that came in and just went out of his way to connect with everyone in the clubhouse, really reached out to people, made them feel welcome, inclusive, just a great guy to be around. Didn't matter if you were a 15-year veteran or a guy like me who had barely been up there, he was going to engage you and talk to you, and just hilarious guy. Just one of those guys that would tell the funniest stories in the clubhouse. Just the stuff he would come up with would just keep guys loose. Love having guys like that around.
Yeah, it sounds like a very important role. And I did want to talk about you being a Rule 5 pick, which was, I guess, when you first came into the majors, and presumably guys like Nick were good to have around. But in terms of the process that happens there, how do you find out that you get picked, and did the A's say anything to you about their expectations? Did they say, oh, we want to keep you on the roster all year, or was it very uncertain for you at the time?
I'm glad you asked that. I actually have a sort of more unusual story than maybe you'd even expect. I was actually in Taiwan. I was caddying for my wife, who's a professional golfer. And with the time change, it was the other side of the world. So it took place while we were sleeping, and I was really excited for the Rule 5. I was disappointed I didn't get added to the 40-man after playing in the fall league, but I just didn't have the fall to make myself indispensable, to force the organization's hand. I just didn't play well enough. And yeah, I was disappointed, but I was looking forward to the Rule 5 and hoping maybe I'd get picked and have a chance to be a platoon guy. And sure enough, I wake up in the morning, it's, you know, 5:45, I'm about to caddy 18 holes, and I get all these emails saying I got Rule 5, I'm on the 40, man. It's really exciting. So it was actually by Houston. And I went to spring with Houston, and I spent just about the entire spring with them. Didn't have a great spring. And they told me right before spring ended that I was not going to make the team. And it was kind of a lot of information to process, because at the same time they told me that I'd also been claimed off waivers by the A's. I was in the dugout at Disney, at the Braves. And I actually had to leave the dugout and get on the next plane to Arizona. So about an hour after they told me, I was on a plane. And I flew back to Arizona. There were about 5 days left in spring. And the A's told me pretty much what I expected, that they were going to give me a look as a right-handed hitting platoon guy And if I made the team, my role would be to hit against lefties. And sure enough, they kept me the whole year. I had an unbelievable experience, got to be part of a playoff team. And it's really an opportunity that I'll never forget. And I can't thank the A's enough for giving me that shot.
Yeah, that was quite the year, of course, for the A's, and it ended in probably not the fashion that you expected, I guess, at the end of 2014 as well, which turned out to be your final game. But that team surprised a lot of people, I guess, and you had some great players on it, of course, like Josh Donaldson. Did you expect Josh to turn into the player that he did with the Blue Jays? Did you see that coming? Because I know he was a good player then, but I don't think he was quite at the same level that he became in 2015.
Right. He was a really good player in 2013. I had never really heard of him. I don't know what I was looking at in the minor leagues. I just kind of had my head under a rock, I guess. But when I got there, I was like, wow, who's this guy? He's a really good player. And it turned out he was Josh Donaldson, the third baseman for the A's. He was hitting sort of down near the lower part of the lineup. He wasn't the established star, but he had a really good year that year. And it was really 2014 that he put himself on the map. Just had an unbelievable season. He was an all-star, and as we've seen, has turned into a superstar.
Yeah, and you also played with Yoenis Cespedes, who got traded partway through the 2014 season, I believe, for John Lester. How was that in the clubhouse? Were people shocked? Did that really have the impact? Because I think a lot of, you know, the narrative around it was that, oh, the A's made a big mistake trading away Cespedes.
Yeah, the narrative is that they traded Cespedes and then that our season basically plummeted from there. And I don't think that's fair. We being the A's front office, made a move that if we got to a short series or even a wild card game, John Lester was the guy that the A's wanted on the mound. And sure enough, we had John Lester on the mound. And we went into the eighth inning of the wild card game with a 4-run lead. He did exactly what the A's picked him up to do. And unfortunately, it didn't work out. But yeah, it's hindsight's 20/20. And I think there's some unfortunate things where Brandon Moss and Donaldson and some of our sort of big hitters the second half of that season might have been a little banged up. And it was just kind of wearing them down a little bit. But unfortunately, the move didn't work out. But I think that gave us a good shot. At the time, it seemed like a pretty gutsy move. And I think it could have worked out. Things had maybe gone a little differently.
Yeah, as you say, it was, you know, less than a couple of innings away from it all working out, really. So it doesn't seem like, you know, these things turn on a knife edge sometimes. And that game, I think, might be one of the most unbelievable pieces of any sport I've ever seen. What was it like to be there with the team and just watch that unfold?
So I was definitely a bubble guy for that roster late in the year. But because of the wild card game, because you can reset the roster after each round, they put a bunch of bench guys on the roster for that game that wouldn't otherwise be on, and if we needed a full starting rotation. So I was on the roster, Andy Perino, Billy Burns, and it was just incredible. It was this playoff, obviously playoff, crazy atmosphere, 45,000 people. Kansas City, they go back and forth with Seattle and the NFL to try to have the loudest football stadium. And so that kind of carried over to the baseball that year, and they were just being as loud as possible. It was deafening in the stadium. And again, I had a pretty good sense that I would have come off the roster if we'd advanced. But just to be part of that team, and we thought we were going to go to Anaheim, it was just heartbreaking. The Royals were such a scrappy team that year. They fought. They kept battling back. It was a really good team. And that team ended up winning the World Series the next year, but it was a really competitive group of guys.
Yeah, they definitely had one of those runs, and I'm a Giants fan, so I'm glad it didn't quite work out for them that year. But it sort of did feel that year that like nothing could go wrong for them; everything just fell their way at the right time.
What Baumgartner did that year was one of the most amazing feats of pitching that I've ever seen.
Yeah, that was remarkable when he came out of the bullpen in game 7. I've never seen anything like that again. So, yeah,
he was throwing a short rest. He comes out in the middle of the game, and there was no question at any point that anyone else was coming in behind him. He was the guy. Then he was going to finish it. It was amazing.
Yeah, it was phenomenal. Kind of after that, and unfortunately, that was your last game in the big leagues, but you did spend a few more seasons in the minors and also in Mexico, I believe. What was that experience like playing in Mexico? I know you hit pretty well there. Was it a good experience for you?
I had the fortune of playing in a stadium that was at 7,000 feet. We were almost 2,000 feet higher than Denver down there, and it was a great place to hit. It was a really nice town. It was this mountain town, beautiful city called Puebla. I had a really good experience in the Mexican League. Unfortunately, I was just away from my family too much, and I got two little kids, and it was time to move on. But there was nothing about the league itself. I would have gone back in a heartbeat if it weren't for basically deciding that it was time to move on. But I had a great experience. They treated me really well down there.
Yeah, it'd certainly be interesting. I know there's been lots of expansion talk about down there. Do you think that would work out if a team ended up in Mexico City or somewhere like that?
There's some really interesting considerations to take into account about Mexico City. First of all, is the union and safety and all that stuff. And I don't necessarily want to get involved in that. But the other really cool thing is the ball and whether they would be able to level the playing field with the baseball. So I didn't know this. I was actually talking about this a couple of days ago, but I was totally wrong. I didn't know this, but the humidor actually wouldn't work for baseballs at Mexico City, because despite the high altitude, there's actually high humidity in Mexico City. So in order to have an effect on the baseball, they'd have to turn it up so high that it would make the baseballs so heavy that they'd fall outside the regulation weight.
Oh, wow.
So I did not know that. So Phoenix and Denver are dry, so they can use relatively low humidity in the humidor and still have the effect, but it wouldn't work in Mexico City. I had no idea. I read this unbelievable article by Ben Lindbergh at The Ringer a year ago where he went through all these things. It was really cool. But so I didn't know that they would have to do that. If you can't deaden the baseball, it might be sort of a crazy launching pad. I don't know if the air there is really conducive to regular baseball. I mean, we've seen that Olympic records are suspect when they happen down there. The ball flies like crazy in Mexico City. I took BP there, and you know, you get jammed or hit one off the end of the bat and it flies over the fence. So I don't know what a Major League Baseball game would look like. You could make the left field fence 380, but then you have a huge outfield. It's not fair to the pitchers either.
They get that problem at Coors as well now, don't they? They made the field so big that it's actually just a really difficult outfield to play.
Yeah, exactly. Plus, there's anecdotal evidence about balls just – they flatten out. Breaking balls just don't move there. So the city itself is a huge fan base, enormous fan base, and it would open up the Mexican TV market, and I think there'd be a lot of money involved. The trick would just be figuring out how to make it normal baseball rather than something you'd see in a video game.
Yeah, it's definitely sounds like quite the challenge. I wanted to talk about another aspect of international baseball, and that's the World Baseball Classic, which is obviously of some great interest to us and our listeners. And you played for Team Israel both in the 2013 qualifier and then in 2017 when you made it to the main event. So first of all, you actually played against Team GB. So what do you remember of those games and how they went? And what did you think of the British squad?
They were really good. We played them twice. The WBC qualifier is kind of a strange format, and it hurt us in 2012, but we ended up playing twice. Really good team. I ended up actually a couple months ago, I ran into Antoine Richardson out in spring training, and he and I kind of talked. He was on that team, and good group of guys, a bunch of speedy guys, crafty guys. They had some veterans. They had some guys who could pitch. Really good game. We put up some separation there in the final game a little bit. We took some good swings, got to their bullpen a little bit, but that was a really good team. Really fun to play against.
Yeah, we're hopeful that maybe next time we can make it to the main thing, because it'd be a lot of fun. And I think everybody got really into it, even though the UK didn't have a team in it. But it would be a lot of fun to see us have one over there next time.
Absolutely. I would love to see him get in it. Plus, I had the chance to talk to a handful of guys on that team, and really good guys. You know, we are fortunate enough to have already qualified for the next one, but love to see Great Britain or the UK get in. Just really good players on that team. I think we faced Michael Roth maybe twice in that tournament somehow. I think he started game one, and he definitely started game one, and then he might have pitched a little bit in game three. I remember him from, I think I faced him was with the Angels. Just really good pitcher. You know, he's a good college pitcher, just mixes up on both sides of the plate, good change up. Pitch well against us.
Yeah, and we've got PJ Conlon, who made his major league debut this year as well. He's from Northern Ireland, so another major leaguer to add to the books that who hopefully we'll see more internationally. Oh,
that's cool.
So the Israel squad then went on and did really well at the main WBC, winning the first pool. You beat Korea then, I believe, and then you got to play Cuba and the host Japan in the Tokyo Dome. So what was that like, playing Japan in front of their home fans?
Yeah, I've been fortunate to have some really cool experiences in baseball. Some experiences I never really dreamed that I would have. I played in Fenway Park. I played in Yankee Stadium. I played at AT&T in San Francisco. But playing in the Tokyo Dome was one of the most amazing things I've ever been part of. We went out at 5 o'clock for a 7 o'clock game. There were already 40,000 people in the stands, screaming, instruments, coordinated cheers, so into it. Every single pitch, playoff atmosphere. The Japanese team, we were just astounded at how good these guys are. For whatever reason, there's this totally false notion in the U.S. that Japanese baseball is kind of 4A baseball. And guys like me that have gotten to the big leagues and maybe looked for some opportunities over in Asia, we know that's not true. But I think just in general, there's that perception, which is totally false. But when you play against these guys, you realize that these are major league baseball players over there, and they are so good. They're so dominant. They can hit, they can pitch. You know, we see a lot of splitters over there, but the atmosphere was so engaged, and it just felt like we were in the World Series.
Yeah, it seems unbelievable whenever you see clips. I'd love to go to a game over there in person, because the fans, I mean, it seems, you know, quite like a really raucous football game here almost. They get really, really nuts about it, don't they?
It really is. That, I guess that's how I'd say it. It was like an SEC college football game, maybe watching, you know, Alabama Auburn or something. It was really fun.
And in terms of how the team did, obviously they got kind of a bit of a following, and I think a lot of people over there in the States got well behind them. Were you guys kind of surprised at how competitive the team was? Because you beat some good squads. I think you beat the Netherlands in the first ball game, and they've obviously got some good players through their connections in the Caribbean as well. So were you guys kind of a bit surprised at how well you competed, or were you all kind of, you had a few major leaguers in that squad, so it was not such a surprise to you?
Baseball's a funny game. You play this really long schedule. Baseball is really not meant to be decided in one game. So we had a team that, with the experience and the talent we had, we knew that we could beat anybody on any given day. It was just a matter of whether we would perform on that day, whether we would get the pitching we know we're capable of, whether we would swing the bats the way we were capable of. And it turns out that we played three really good games over in South Korea. And things came together. We had some amazing pitching performances. Josh Zide, who unfortunately couldn't be here today, came out of the pen at the end of that South Korea game and just a nail-biter of a game and held him scoreless for three innings. Jason Marquis basically came out of retirement and pitched great for us. So we knew we had guys that could compete, and it was just they just happened to step up for us on the right days.
Yeah, you certainly had a very fun squad as well. And I think one thing that John wanted me to ask about was Cody Decker and his mensch on a bench. What was playing with Cody like? Because he's like a fun guy.
Cody and I go back a long way. Known him for, I don't know, probably 10 years now. We came up together in the minor leagues, and Josh, Cody, and I were all on the original Team Israel team in 2012, and Cody and I played together in the minors and various places since then, and he is just one of the big personalities in baseball, just outgoing, engaging guy, brings people together in the clubhouse. You know where he is probably before you can hear him before you can see him. But he's just one of the great clubhouse guys I've been around. Really, really comes up with fun stuff to bring a team together. And the mensch was, it was really funny. In the qualifier, we had a little mini one. It was, you know, like a miniature stuffed animal, basically. And once we won the qualifier, he announced that we got a giant 6-foot one, and somehow he was going to get over to Asia. I think he put it in the, like, a duffel bag on the Trans-Pacific flight, and next thing we know, he was walking through the airport with a 6-foot stuffed rabbi in South Korea. And so the media over there, it's kind of a novelty having over there. And the mensch is a Yiddish word, and I think people were trying to figure out how to translate that into Korean, which I don't think we came up with a good translation, but there's definitely a pretty impressive novelty to have over there.
Yeah, definitely. One of the other legends of Jewish baseball we wanted to ask about is Sean Green, who came over to the UK last year and participated in the home run derby we had in Hyde Park. And he looked great. He was hitting line drives all over the place, even years after retiring. What did you learn a lot from Sean? Did you have much contact with him and just kind of your perceptions of him as a player, really?
He was around us in 2012. In the qualifier in Jupiter, Florida, when we lost to Spain, he actually played one of the games, but then the other games he was sort of a hitting coach. We learned a ton from him. I really wish I could have spent more time around him, because in terms of the mental game and the physical game, just marrying those two approaches, one of the best I've ever seen. I really wish I could have spent more time and learned more from him, because the time I did spend with him, I learned a ton. He's just very in tune with the psychological aspects of hitting. It's very physical, but over the course of a game, over the course of a season, hitting is incredibly psychological, and he has just learned some really interesting things in that regard. He wrote a really good book about sort of the psychological aspects of baseball, which I'm a huge fan of, and again, I wish I could have spent more time with him.
Yeah, we spoke to him briefly, and he seemed like a very chill guy, kind of intense but chilled at the same time. It was quite the personality.
He was, and he was so good too. It was fun watching him. He was really good.
Yeah, I was surprised. I kind of did a piece on all the guys we had over, Carlos Peña and Cliff Floyd and Sean, and I kind of didn't, having come to the game relatively recently, I didn't know a huge amount about him, and I was amazed when I was looking at his numbers and kind of watching some of his highlights at how good he was, because he's not got the same kind of profile as many of the big hitters from the 90s, early 2000s, but he was an unbelievable player from everything I've seen.
Yeah, he was.
Just on one, touch on one more thing that you kind of mentioned, the difference between the season long grind and having these kind of one-off knockout style pool games. How much information do you get about the other teams? Because presumably most of these players are guys that you've not seen before, or if you have, you've seen them rarely. Did you get much in the way of scouting reports, or was it kind of going in blind?
The staff that we had for the WBC last year, or last time around, our manager, Jerry Weinstein, our sort of assistant general manager, Alex Jacobs, he's in the front office with the Diamondbacks. These guys put an incredible amount of work into scouting reports. It was actually some of the most detailed scouting reports I'd ever seen. And it wasn't through any of the normal channels. They couldn't just go online and find it the easy way. They did really hard work to come up with scouting reports for people that we, for the most part, never played against. And so we went into the tournament and the qualifier and then the WBC itself with just this incredible wealth of information. And it was all because of the hard work of our, basically our staff.
Yeah, it sounds like a very difficult thing to research because it's so easy, obviously, with the major leagues to look up stats and video and that. But I'm guessing most of these leagues, if they do have any stat keeping, it must be incredibly basic compared to what's available at Baseball Reference or Fangraphs, places like this now.
Yeah, but they, again, they worked really hard. And yeah, we had, I'd say we had basic stuff like velocity and pitch usage, just general game stuff about speed or contact. But even that was a lot of work for them to basically collect in leading up to the qualifier. And they did a great job.
And one final thing that you've mentioned, kind of players who basically retired kind of coming back, Jason Markey and Sean, of course. Is that something that you would consider doing for Team Israel again in the future, or are you done now? Will you be hanging up the cleats for good?
I'm done. I'll miss playing, but it was time to move on. I had an incredible time playing, but it was time to move on.
Yeah, and you're going back to Duke, right, to do an MBA. Is that with a view to kind of working within sports more, or have you got kind of wider plans than that?
Yeah, right now it's just about trying to learn as much as possible in the next really 2 years, and working in baseball would be an absolute dream come true, but right now just focusing on learning.
Yeah, well, I think it's about time to wrap it up, so thank you very much for joining us, Nate. And would you like to let people know where they can find you on Twitter and where to find the show on FanCred as well?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter at Nate Fryman. And we're on FanCred, the launch angle. Right now we're at Tuesdays at, I believe it would be 5 p.m.
Noon Eastern is 5 p.m. here. Yeah, so when people get, just as they finish work, they can tune in and watch you and Josh.
Awesome. Yeah, that's right, exactly. But it's live video, so don't watch us while driving. You turn on the audio or something, but it's live video. So if we're driving, we can watch it on. It's available on demand later too. So
great. Well, I'm sure plenty of our listeners will be checking that out. And yeah, good luck with everything, Nate. And hopefully, we'll be seeing more articles and maybe you in a front office one day. I think that would be a lot of fun.
That would be incredible. So yeah, thanks, Darius. Thanks for having me.
No problem. Nice talking to you.